This episode of The Blutter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. Get the true crime that's worth your time delivered to your inbox every weekday at bestevidence.fyi. And remember, 2,000 paid subscribers by August of next year means that we're covering the Theranos trial in person. And now, on with today's episode.
I've been on this ship for 11 years. And every time I bring it up around somebody, they say, this shit is unheard of. How you get 11 years of probation? I never really looked at it like a nightmare. I looked at it as a real life for a black kid in America. You know what I'm saying? This is real life.
In which the law is extremely interested in harassing hip-hop artists when they're alive, in Amazon's upcoming limited series Free Meek, and not all that interested in bringing hip-hop artists justice when they're dead in Remastered's Who Killed Jam Master Jay. But at least we've got a favorite talking head interviewee to take our minds off this maddening state of affairs. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 107. Mr. David Seabrook, come sit next to us, but we will get back to him. In the meantime, welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to figure out which true crime is worth your time. I'm joined today by my Best Evidence newsletter working partner slash fellow Manson fatigue sufferer, Eve Beatty. Welcome back, Eve.
Hello, Sarah.
Let's get right into our most wanted section. You were pretty excited about this one. This is the upcoming series from Amazon Prime, Free Meek. It drops on the 9th of August. That's this coming Friday as you're listening to this. It's 5 episodes. We got screeners of all 5. Hashtag screener privilege. Let me read you the case file. It's not really the case file because we would be here all day. At 19 years old, Meek Mill was arrested for illegal possession of a firearm and assaulting a police officer, crimes for which he received 11 to 23 months inside and 10 years probation. While his assigned judge, Denise Brinkley, continued hauling him back into court on capricious alleged violations and occasionally sending him back to jail, his legal team was taking a deep dive into whether the initial charges had any merit. Just a couple weeks ago, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court dismissed all the charges and pulled Brinkley off Mill's case at last, but it's not the fault of Free Meek that it was overtaken by headlines. Okay, I really liked this one. Eve, you were super excited about it. What did you think overall?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that, if I have a criticism or, you know, sort of a source of frustration, it's that it is... so focused on, you know, telling us about Meek Mill's case without giving us any sort of critical backbone or devil's advocacy. I mean, look, like I'll tell you, like, you know, my personal feelings are exactly what Meek Mill said in that clip you used at the beginning. And I'm glad that that was said so early on in the show, that his story... this is not a case here of, like, you know, cops messing with a successful black man, you know, pulling him over because he's driving, you know, a Mercedes or something. This is a young black kid who got arrested and even though he was fighting these cases, managed to build a career for himself as an artist. And this is an extremely common story. So I was excited to watch it because I wanted to see this common story of a young man, most often black, trapped in the probation system. And I was also excited because in this case, as opposed to, you know, so many of the stories, almost all the players are black. So we don't have a simple sort of, like, you know, whatever, you know, Sam Rockwell, you know, in the judicial robe yelling at, you know, Denzel Washington or something. It's right. A lot more nuanced. And, you know, so that to me, from a narrative standpoint, excited me. But I wish, I have been thinking a lot about, like, how would I like to see this? So we have a guy who is sort of brought on to defend the actions. I mean, I was going to be like, ooh, I don't want to spoil it. But you can, you know, whatever. You have access to the news. You're spoiled. But so there's this guy who is brought on to sort of provide talking points to defend the judge. He's, you know, he's basically a PR guy. He's a PIO. Even at one point, he's like, oh, it's getting really hard for me. He's taking off the mic. Not smart.
Oh, yeah. No, we have, you know, we have a clip of
that. Oh, right.
We'll get to it.
Okay, well, yeah. So I don't want to jump ahead. But other than that, and people recounting what the arresting officer said about the case, we don't have any. I wish that for the sake of the show, producers had brought in somebody to poke holes in the story and push back on some of this stuff from the get-go, to push back on, you know, well, why were you riding a wheelie? Why were, you know, push back on the initial case, just so we felt like there was a little bit of rigor associated and it wasn't just a, you know what I mean? Like just, a, you know, it felt, it got a little corn syrupy for me at times.
Yeah, at times for me too. And I think that what you have to keep in mind about this particular project is that it is produced by Jay-Z, among others. He appears in it. And it is focused on, like, you know, Meek Mill is a hip hop artist, and it is focused in large part on the effects of this Javerian series of probationary events on his career, not just on his career, and the fact that the probation system seems at times designed to prevent anyone from being a rap artist, but also that it fueled a lot of his music, a lot of which you hear. Mm-hmm. And there is a device that you mentioned in our episode rundown doc involving, like, I was a little weirded out by the fact that they felt they had to basically, like, caption his music for us in all caps. Did you feel like that's what was going on there?
It reminded me a little bit of, do you remember, like, those old, like, sort of sing-along shows where there'd be the bouncing ball over the words or something? Like, I do think that his music and how his struggles with the probation system informed his art is important and is relevant, but it was hard, you know, the hands on the hands there. I was not wild about that.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that you have a whole bunch of stories here, and I think that Free Meek is not entirely successful at picking a lane, because I do think that the effects of the criminal, quote, justice, quote, system on hip-hop artists, and then what is the euphemism they use? Police contact?
Mm-hmm.
That the way that that fuels the work a lot of the time, I think that's a, like, Ken Burns on PBS length and depth study of American cultural history, and this is trying to do that through the lens of one guy, which is, you know, an admirable take on it. But I'm not entirely sure that you can do that and also, like, kind of partway through enter the private investigators and that whole thing. And they're, like, you know, visiting the scene of the initial arrest. And it just felt like they were getting sucked into these true crime show tropes. My notes for that section where they're, like, standing there and not quite with a surveyor camera, but basically reviewing, like, where the cops said they were standing and how this worked with the confidential informant, da da da. There is something about true crime properties where they oversubscribe the value of going to the place or being in the place or standing in the same place. It's like true crime tours. I don't understand those.
You know what it makes me think of in the most recent Halloween movie, how the podcasters show up at the mental hospital to, like, good audio of Michael Myers. I mean, this is obviously irrelevant to what we're talking about, but reminds me of. Because I think to myself, well, listen, you know Michael Myers isn't going to talk to you, you stupid podcasters. I mean, those people are bad podcasters. I think we all know that. But, you know he's not going to talk to you. So you're just standing there with, like, your little tape recorder or whatever, like, hey, Michael, here's the mask. I mean, that's how I feel anytime it's like, it becomes that sort of very NPR-y footsteps crunching through the maples.
Yeah, knows something. Like early episodes of Breakdown, which is a podcast I like and respect a lot, and stopped doing that eventually. But, you know, they're like standing out there with like a laser pointer. And it's like, I just think the number of times that this has ever done any good. It's like, how many times has the Identikit helped? Twice?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I understand that you have to give me visual interest. Otherwise, I might as well just read the Rolling Stone coverage, you know, which is excellent and I strongly recommend it. But, you know, I understand that you have to do something. But in a case like this, it's, you know, it's a corner in Philly. You could give me so many other things to give. You show me more of Meek Mill's kid, who I love and think is so adorable. And I do not like children.
He is really cute.
Yeah, you can give me other stuff to look at. You can give me footage of what it was like inside the prison. I mean, and that, you know, is so glossed over. The fact that he did spend time actually within a correctional facility is something that, you know, we're going to talk about how, you know, things sort of sag at a certain point. But it's so strange to me that we don't even talk about what was probably one of the most formative periods for Mill, which was that he actually was locked up.
Yeah. And then there are these weird elliptical periods. I mean, I think if they were doing it from this standpoint, and like, the, you know, Meek Mill is their subject, so they're not going to, you know, they're not going to not focus on him as an artist and how these industries, the carceral industry and the hip hop industry, were feeding each other poison, basically, you know, fine. But then just do that, and kind of, you can sort of make everything else, like, if it's impressionistic, it's impressionistic. But at times when it's like more of a straight ahead, let's unpack who this arresting officer was and what this task force was about and whether there was corruption on the Philadelphia police force, which they're, yeah, doy.
Yeah, no shit.
That it's like, this wasn't uninteresting footage. And the other thing is, like, most of the episodes are like 35, 40 minutes long. So yeah. They never get so in the weeds that you're like bored and checking Twitter, or at least I wasn't until the last episode. But it seemed like the strength of this is that it wasn't necessarily really, like, it was so individual and so personal to him. And I think they should have dwelt in that instead of doing this. Like, God bless Billy Jensen, who has a sense of humor about what he does. But, like, do I need a Billy Jensen crazy wall? I don't, honestly. Yeah. And going back to what you were talking about that what we're accustomed to seeing is a white judge coming down like 2 tons of bricks on a defendant of color. The assigned judge in this case is black, and like we'll sort of get more into it, but the point that they keep making this point about the fact that he and his team thought maybe this was going to go better for him than it might have otherwise. But they also keep making the point throughout the entire series, before you really even dig into whether what the cops say about what happened in the initial contact is true, whether that holds up. He keeps making the point, like, if I had actually pointed a gun anywhere near a police officer anywhere, I would not be sitting here talking to you because they would have aired me out.
And this is reiterated by other police officers who were not directly involved in the arrest, that
yes,
he would be gone. That
many times.
What is, There's, I think, one guy who says, if, you know, if I even saw a flicker of him moving the gun toward me, he'd be dead.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're all human beings who live in the world. We know that that is true.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that Judge Brinkley also knew that. But anyway, these two facts are sort of braided together in clip two.
All rise for the Honorable Judge Denise Brinkley.
Denise Brinkley, she ended up being my trial judge. And when I seen her, I'm thinking like, yeah, damn, a black judge, I got a black lady. Where I come from, you really gotta worry about the white judge. When you get a black male or female judge, some of them can comb through the scenarios because they come from the places we come and they can see, all right, that's bullshit. He pointed a gun at a cop. Let me check his medical records. Does this guy ever had any record of being crazy?
I mean, there it is. That he was kind of hoping that there would be a more felt understanding of the general circumstances. And there really was not. And they spend really a lot of time underlining how strangely overinvested she was in everything about Meek Mill. Here's clip three.
I always felt like the judge was trying to control the way she thought I should be. She put me in etiquette class because I said the word pissed. It cost me $10,000 because she had to choose the person I had to go to, which I thought was a scam. I used to go to court, she was like, I ain't like your haircut and shit like that. I'm like, why you even worrying about my life? I'm in here for 5 hours just for a probation hearing, not even having a violation, just to talk about your life. She was focusing way too much attention on me. 8 o'clock at night, I'm doing community service on a Saturday. The judge is at my community service. Why are you at my community service?
A judge showing up to your community service, etiquette class with a person I know. When you're a sitting judge, you just can't do things like that because it looks like you are overly invested in just Meek.
Which she definitely was. And while I think that they outlined that effectively, and we have another clip that is like where it felt to me like his legal team should have started putting some pressure on the Department of Probation to like get her taken off the case. And if this was attempted, we're not told. But then at the same time, and we're shown on screen a litany of the tiny little things that she would haul him back into court for, like failure to report a dentist appointment. It needed etiquette classes. There was some travel thing where he took a train that was delayed and then he didn't report that, like just on and on. But then, you know, he does have these dental problems. He gets addicted to Percocet as a result. And also he's basically on house arrest, thanks to Judge Brinkley. And that goes on for a while. And he fails a couple of urine tests. But then someone asks if he has a problem. I think his sister. And he says he does. And he goes to rehab. And that's the end of that, kind of. And we're not really told like how that was handled as far as Judge Brinkley and sort of interacting with that as someone who has to be passing drug tests. Like, I'm just not sure that the information was ordered as well as it could have been. Not to mention that some of the reenactments were like, this guy was born in 1987. Why is everyone in his flashbacks of his parents styled like the 70s? Anyway.
Now, is the Percocet incident, is that also when he had the beef with Drake on Twitter?
I think so.
I'm not basing this off my own knowledge of, you know, celebrities I follow on Twitter or anything. I'm basing this off the show. I mean, of course, I saw like headlines at the time, right? Like, you know, Meek Mill and Drake are beefing on Twitter. I'm so sick of thinking about social media today. I don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah,
but,
same.
Right. I mean, like, I'm like, Meek Mill and Drake beefing on Twitter is the most positive social media thing I can think of on a day like today. But,
yeah,
you know, like, I feel like, you know, there's this piece of footage that resonated with me because I remember when it happened, where he was high on pills or whatever. He was all fucked up and he was doing a show in the Bay Area. And I mean, I remember people talking about it. I do remember people, you know, talking about it on Twitter, but also like coverage of it where it was like he was, you know, stoned out of his gourd. And I do remember even thinking at the time, like, isn't this guy on probation? Like, how's he getting away with, you know, being all messed up or seeming, I mean, he says like, oh, I'm high on, and, you know, he says, I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, you know, I'm all fucked up on the Bay or something like that, right? Like, you know, he was very publicly playing out this sort of dysfunction on social media and on the shows that he was able to play. And I felt like we kind of just sort of got a quick drive-by there. And I think that that would have been interesting. And I also think that from a service standpoint, I think that that would have been useful to what I suspect will be many other young Black men who are going to watch this show and, you know, who may face sort of the banality of house arrest or something else. Like, I think seeing, you know, the problems that he endured in part as a result of this stuff is a useful lesson. So talking more about, you know, I got jacked up on pills because I was depressed about this and because I was bored as hell. And then I started fucking around on Twitter and I could have really ruined my life and my career that way too, would have been helpful to discuss more. And he seems very open about his problems. So I don't blame Meek Mill for not talking about it. I blame the show.
For sure, no. He was very open about it. And I think that he wanted to, I think he wants viewers to understand, like, he needed the help, he accepted the help, he embraced the help, and then that was that, as far as that problem. But there are a couple of passing comments by Talking Head interviewees about the difficulties of fitting the square peg of a hip-hop career in which you have no choice, and this is throughout the music industry, you have no choice but to tour. That's the only way to make any money. And fitting that square peg into the round hole of a very strict probation, and specifically a judge who seemed to be taking what I would call a 90s Bill Cosby attitude.
Yes.
Towards Meek Mill, that she was just like,
pull up your pants.
Yep, pull up your pants. And it's like, okay, that is fascinating to me. That this is an industry where I think there is a certain branding requirement of lawlessness for some performers. And sure. How do you match that up with, you know, a system that is going to reinforce all the worst consequences for you, a performer of color, always? I mean, that's way above my pay grade. And I don't know if the documentarians were like, well, you know, let's just shave off the tip of the iceberg and then, you know.
But, you know, a lot of this stuff, though, too, is the same sort of thing that would have a terrible impact on anybody who doesn't have a white collar job. You know, The curfew of 8 p.m., that rules out most service jobs, that rules out retail, you know, that rules out a lot of professions, you know, that you could, I mean, Meek Mill is lucky in that he had an income stream when a lot of these people who are on probation don't have that and they can't pursue that.
She tried to.
Yep.
Cauterize that too, that she's like, you're not allowed to make any music or make any money off music. Like,
that was wild to me. Like, I did not understand, like, I'm not saying that it would have improved the show if they had really gone down that legal hole, but I'm like, at what point does this become a First Amendment violation when you're prohibiting people from making music? I mean, this, I'm certainly not going to say that I know more about the law than Meek Mill's lawyers, who I'm sure are very good, but that to me seemed like such an obvious and easy play right there.
That did seem like it was not legal for her to do, but then they don't really get into how she got away with any of this. And then at one point, she calls Meek Mill and his then significant other, Nicki Minaj, into her chambers, no lawyers, no stenographer, and makes a couple of suggestions. Clip four.
This is out of earshot of reporters and all the lawyers.
She asked me about doing a remix to Boys to Men, Bend the Knee, and shout some important people out like my mother herself, Nikki. I was astonished that a judge even talking about do a remix to a song. Like, you know what I'm saying? I'm not even like an R&B singer. So, you know, that kind of was an eyebrow raiser.
But this says something about, you know, like we're criticizing some of the structural elements of the show. But to me, the real through line are the interviews with Meek Mill. And he's extraordinarily charismatic, but not just that. He also has, it's remarkable to me that he can demonstrate such a sense of humor given, you know, what he's faced. But there is something about him, like there's sort of a wry spin he puts on a lot of his experiences that make, sort of this litany of mistreatment a little more palatable. And, you know, like the time when I felt like the show hit its groove the most is when he was just talking. I mean, that's his job, right? His job is to talk in a very compelling way over, beats. And so guess what? He can also just do it when he's just talking. But he's just, you know, I never really thought about him as a person. I just listened to his music and I was like, God, I like this guy.
Yeah, I think that, again, if they had made it a little more, if they hadn't felt quite so obligated to stick to certain true crime-y tropes, I think this would have been a little more effective, because just him talking is often enough. I mean, the fact that what ended up, like the disposition of this case ended up coming down to this task force kind of getting Serpico'd by a couple of dudes who used to be on it and then did time. And then they were like, well, time to dig ourselves out of this karmically. I mean, that's not uninteresting. Don't get me wrong. And that's basically how it ends up on my plate. I think there's no way to like not have that braided into everything that he's saying, because this has been his entire adult life dealing with this horse shit. So it's going to come through. So maybe just like he is a storyteller, just maybe let him do it. Like, nothing against the PIs who are like totally fine on camera. And this isn't uninteresting stuff, but it was like there were kind of two different styles of documentary that were a little bit like they were in, stuffed in a pillowcase and fighting each other a little bit, which is too bad. I mean, overall, again, it's very watchable, but it could have been even more than it was. So,
yeah, well, I think you nailed it. I feel like somebody came in, like, you know how when you're reading a story sometimes and you can feel the editor's hand on it? Yeah. I felt that same thing. Like, I can tell you exactly the moment in what episode where I thought somebody came in and said, all right, you need to make it more true crimey.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can I. My notes are like, and here's the network note.
Yep. Yep. Like, and you can really feel it.
Oh, we're going to give Jay-Z some notes now on how to tell a story.
And I sort of like, cool. I get it intellectually. They're like, this is what you do to be credible. This is, this is how you write a story. Use the inverted pyramid. Like, this is how
this is how you get it picked up by us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Here are the beats that you have to hit. And when you have to hit it, and this is when, exactly. And this is, when so-and-so has to show up and do, and be on the scene and everything else. And I wish that whoever had put it together had maybe had a surer hand or more support and had allowed it to just emerge a little more organically.
Certainly, Roc Nation was like very upfront and not shy about being like, this is ridiculous, and let's get a hashtag on this thing because it's kind of the only way to move the needle sometimes. So I think there's also that aspect of it in the ways it's true crimey. So I almost wish that they had just been more transparent about, like, well, you know, we needed to make this a true crime product. This is us doing that. Hey.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to skip. There's a clip with this guy, Jeffrey Walker, who was like the whistleblower of this narcotics task force, just talking about what, like, utter disrespectful assholes some of the cops were that he was working with. Let's consider that stipulated and skip ahead to what I had in my notes as the jinx moment, which is the rep for this, for the judge, talking about why she made the decision she made, and then continuing to talk as he takes his mic off. Some parts of this are a little quiet, so listeners, crank your volume for the second half of this clip.
If they do that, Judge Brickley is going to grant this petition and he's going to go free. If they don't do that, she's going to deny this petition and then he's going to have to appeal to a higher court to see if they'll do it. That's just really is that simple.
Thanks.
Good job. Thank you.
Thanks,
sir.
So much.
Let me tell you something. That was hard to do because defending this judge, she's now becoming. Why does she just go at this point? And she looks fucking awful. I don't know why she's going to fuck her ass about this guy. He's just, if I was a judge in this case, prosecution and defense agree. Good. Goodbye. See you later. End it.
Yeah, basically, he's like, she looks terrible. I don't know why she's got a bug up her ass about this guy. The prosecutor and Meek Mill's attorneys agree how this should be disposed of to end it. So,
well, and as a reporter, you have those conversations all the time. But the thing is, the person's smarter and they say, listen, on background, or they say, listen, off the record. And you say, yes, on background, yes, off the record. That this guy wasn't thinking, said it while he was still mic'd, didn't say, like, listen, can we go off the record and have everybody agree or anything? You know, which off
or
the record,
check
obviously.
And see if your mic is off, which you only have to do this kind of thing a couple of times to be like, you know, just wait till it's off and then belch or, you know. Talk shit about the boom operator or whatever it is you're going to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But lots of times, and it's, you know, actually like sort of it's a common PIO move to sort of get the reporter on their side too. Yeah, I know that the DA is being, you know, real weirdo about this, but, you know, I think that, you know, this A, B, and C, and it's true. It completely works as a manipulation. Then as a reporter, you're less likely to, you know, go hard. Because you're like, oh, they're a person too. And, you know, if I do this, I get more access later. And, you know,
to use the material that you got because they, quote, made a mistake. So you'll do them a solid because they kind of agree with you.
Yeah, exactly.
But this felt like a little bit of an amateurish gotcha in that way to me.
To me, it sounded like this guy wanted to be like, I mean, I think he probably did think that the judge was fucked up, but I think he wanted to be like to, you know, he knew he was dealing with, and I do think that there's this factor, and I think that's what we're seeing with the judge in some of these periods too, this factor of being a little bit blinded by power and influence and, you know, Nicki Minaj and everything else. And so you make some rookie mistakes that if you weren't quite as overwhelmed by being around famous people or knowing that you're talking to people who know Jay-Z or something, you maybe would keep your shit together.
Yeah. Overall, I think it comes in at just under 3 hours total. And if you aren't that familiar with Meek Mill himself, which I wasn't prior to this, like I knew a little about the case and that was it. This is a great introduction. Like Eve said, he's very charismatic and I recommend it. Like it's not a huge time suck that's only sort of a B minus. Like, as I said, very entertaining sit. I don't think the last episode is actually all that necessary. Like it seemed a little bit like they were stalling, hoping that something better would happen before they had to submit a locked cut and then it did like 2 weeks ago, which sucks for them.
Well, I think what happened there is that the state Supreme Court hearing, I think it got postponed twice. So I think that your instincts are correct.
Yeah.
I think that they sort of thought, okay, so our first beat's going to be the prosecutors saying we should drop the case. And then our second beat is going to be the Supreme Court, you know, making these decisions. And then since the actual hearing wasn't until last week and they probably had to have everything done they gave us the screeners. It was a while ago.
Yeah.
So
it's been months. Yeah.
So it just seems like at a certain point they were like, you know, and I think that that's one of the challenges when you're dealing with an ongoing case like this. Like, when do you sort of, you know, cut the tape and say, all right, here's where we're going to tell the story. I feel like it's the same challenge that Lifetime's going to have to keep dealing with R. Kelly, right? They're going to have to keep coming back to the story, which is like good for them. That's good for money, but it's tough when you're trying to create, you know, sort of a cogent narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. So once again, that's a Free Meek. It drops Friday, August 9th on Amazon. If you are a Prime member, it is free. I recommend it.
Yeah.
Remastered is a show that we have talked about in another context on The Blotter Presents before. I believe Mark Blankenship and I talked about the Killing of Sam Cooke episode. Many of the episodes seem to concern performers of color whose murders are still not solved or really understood. Today, it is Who Killed Jam Master Jay. Here's the case file. In late October 2002, and can I just say, I can't believe it's already that long ago. What the fuck? Two suspects entered the studio of Jason Mazill, a.k.a. Run DMC's Jam Master Jay, shot him to death, and disappeared into the cold, rainy night. Friends and associates have their theories, both on who done it and on why the case remains open. In Remastered's 2018 episode on the unsolved murder of a hip-hop pioneer. I think that generally this show, while it is well made, suffers somewhat from the same issue that we were talking about in Free Meek, which is that it feels like it has to straddle the two lanes of considered music documentary and true crime product. I think these things are not in as much conflict as they can seem like they are in these properties. Would you agree with that? Did you like this one? Did you think it was boring? What'd you think of this?
I was trying to figure out the audience.
That's basically what I'm saying.
Listening to an interview with Anthony Mackie a couple of years ago, and Anthony Mackie said, nobody ever needs to see Batman's parents die in an alley again. And I felt the same way. I thought there is absolutely
another reason to love Anthony Mackie. Like, we didn't have enough.
Oh my God. Right. Seriously. The list is as long as my arm. Mm. But I mean, I felt the same way. There is no one who's watching this show who is not familiar with Jam Master Jay, how Jam Master Jay joined the group, you know, that he wasn't there at the get-go, his influence on the fashion, you know, that he was the one who, you know, did the shell-toed Adidas, that the, you know, that the Adidas without laces is a signifier of prison garb. Could I sound more white with that last line? Jesus Christ, I hope my husband doesn't listen to this.
Garb.
I know,
look,
I know. My husband will say this in 3 years. I'm so sorry.
Are.
Don't at me, guys. I'm sorry. This is just how I talk. But I mean, I feel like if you're watching the show, if you care enough to watch the show, if you're going to watch Free Meek, if you don't know who Meek Mill is, you're going to, I mean, I think that that's very likely. Nobody's going to be watching this if you don't know about Run DMC. So like, it was like, I felt like it was a really, really long time before we got to the actual homicide we got sort of the lesson about Run DMC. And I thought that that was a really weird decision.
Well, this was my issue with it. This is two stories. And they both have the same ending, kind of, for lack of a better way to put it. But while I appreciated the careful scene setting about Run DMC, then it's like, all right, well, then I kind of want to keep watching that documentary and talking about, like, one of the interviewees is talking about how by the late 80s, their sunnier, happier brand of hip hop was not the fashion anymore. And so everybody had to figure out something else to do musically to sort of acknowledge that another set of stories was coming up. And but the thing is, like, some of this background information about Mizell's life is, like, not irrelevant to what may have led to his death, but it's not, the background isn't given in that way. It's given in, like, a behind the music kind of way.
Yes,
and
yes,
again,
exactly.
Like, the visuals are really cool, and, like, I like Run DMC a lot. I'm into hearing about the evolution of this style since I, as everybody knows, dress like an extra in a Wes Anderson movie. And, like, it's not uninteresting material, but I'm just not sure that they understand that their stories work together, like that the two things work together. But it's like a very clear dividing line in this episode between, well, now we're talking about Run DMC and now we're talking about this crime that happened, and that, like, the bridge between them is not really.
Well,
which is,
and
too
this
bad.
Is something that I'm struggling with is, obviously, it's difficult to tell the story of Run DMC without involving Russell Simmons, alleged sexual assailant Russell Simmons. So this show was made in 2018. The allegations were out there. Multiple allegations have been made against this guy. He's denied them all. But they're there. This is an actual issue. And I do feel that many of the allegations against him have a strong semblance of credibility. And so his sort of top to bottom denial of all this, like, he doesn't even do the, well, I'm sorry if I did something that might have made you uncomfortable. Like, it's just straight up, no, these are, you know, all these people are lying. And it, in my opinion, you know, casts into question his credibility on other matters that might involve crime as well. So I wonder, when you're making the show, how you figure out how to integrate him in a way that doesn't compromise your argument. And I don't know if it was successful, but I also have, you know, this concern about the allegations of sexual assault against this man.
Well, he also wasn't in it as much as you would expect.
True.
Honestly, if the show didn't have some reservations about his reliability as a witness, but it is, I forget what documentary we were talking about. Actually, I think it was Surviving R. Kelly, where their archival footage they used included Matt Lauer. And I was like, y'all, ugh. No, not yeah. Him, never him, ever again. This isn't as bad. Certainly, they're not afraid to use people with records, as we'll, sure, as we'll hear later. But the other thing is that some of these theories, like, it sort of seemed clear that nobody involved believed that this was a factor. Like, they just felt like they were obliged to go through, like, you know, crackpot theory number one. It has to do with a beef between 50 Cent, who they all insist on referring to as 50. Like, has anyone ever pronounced it like that in the last, like, 20 years?
I don't know, maybe me. 50 and his prison signifier.
And his prison signifier.
But, and also, in 2002, wasn't 50 Cent kind of too big for the Jam Master J Rome? I just didn't, they didn't seem like they'd be traveling in the same circles. So I don't recall.
I mean, the beef. According to this, Jam Master J discovered 50 Cent. I don't,
right.
But, like, I'm not the keeper of the family tree of New York hip hop, so I don't know. Let's take that as a given. But then the theory is that the beef didn't even involve Jam Master J. So why would somebody who was angry that another artist mentioned like street, like known drug dealer, like titans of the drug dealing trade in a song, like go into Jam Master Jay's studio and be shooting. I don't, it makes no sense. Anyway, here's crackpot theory number one.
There was a theory that Jay's murder was due to people who was really out to get 50 Cent. 50's earlier days carry a lot of controversial baggage. As a child hustler, he would run throughout the streets of Southside Queens that was run by notorious drug kingpin Kenneth Supreme McGriff and Preem's second-in-command, Gerald Prince Miller.
A notorious crack kingpin with ties to the music industry now faces the death penalty. Jurors have convicted Kenneth Supreme McGriff of murder and drug dealing charges.
Rap is very competitive. And, you know, at that time, Murder, Inc. Records, that also hails from out of Queens, was affiliated with Supreme. So after enjoying much success, 50 released a very controversial record that made references to a number of prominent street figures, including Supreme and Prince.
And then they play part of this song. Apparently, the whole reason for including this theory is to show off that they got the rights to this track. Like, I just don't see what this has to do with anything.
I think I'd realized how overwrought the background music was until I was listening to it just now on the headphones.
Yeah,
too.
Same.
Oh my God, calm down.
Yeah. And then the second crackpot theory is like a whole sort of vague miasma of allegations that, and I'm not even sure that I'm inferring correctly, but what I think the first part of this clip is saying is that he put his money on the street to make money back, mob style. The second part of this clip is Mr. David Seabrook, a former guest of the Arizona penitentiary system, who I think might be, if not completely full, then at least 80% full of shit on a lot of these things, but has a certain way of putting things that makes me want him to be commenting on every case in every documentary that I watch. Here is clip 8.
Yo, homie, what's up? Boom, boom, boom. Give me 10. Let me get my 10. Let me get this 10. I'm flip it. Give you 10 back. Let's give you another 10 just for giving it to me. You know, so that's how Jay was with his peoples.
So Jason invested, you know, and tried to double his money and triple his money like we would all do if we had that opportunity. Jason, Curtis Schoons, and myself went to California with the intention of buying coke, buying drugs. But it didn't work out like that, because when Jay got to L.A., it was a plan B, because the dude he went to see wasn't there. Plan B was buying it from someone else. Plan B never works. Never. Okay, Plan B never works in these kind of business.
I really would like to just interview David Seabrook about all the Plan Bs that have bitten him in the ass, because he feels very strongly about this. He goes on to say that this other guy that they bought the drugs from set him up, took the money, and they got no drugs. I don't believe any of this. Were you buying any of this?
Well, I had no idea it was this. Well, I mean, I assume that what he's suggesting is we're not talking about recreational use. We're talking about intent to distribute use, because we're talking about investments and stuff. But I don't understand
investing.
Why you have
any one of us would do, Eve, if we had the opportunity.
I mean, I'm just telling you, my 401k is all in coke. But I don't know. This seemed to me, given sort of my limited awareness of the drug trade, if you had told me, well, he went to Florida to, like, you know, get, you know, an inordinate amount of drugs or something like that, I'd buy it. But I don't think that anybody goes to L.A. to get a good deal on coke.
And flies there?
Yeah. How are you going to get it back? You're renting a U-Haul? I mean,
yeah.
Well, it's just, I think everybody knows that New York has better coke than California, too. So, and if you don't, well, that's why you listen to this podcast. But like,
prank
you
caller,
know,
DEA, prank caller, prank caller.
But I mean, if this were a conversation that was being held in the 70s or something like that, or a time when, you know, I wasn't familiar with life, it would be one thing. But I can tell you right now, in 2003, you did not want to be getting coke in LA. You want, or 2002, I guess. You know, you wanted to be getting coke in New York. And so to come here for it, like, you didn't know anybody? You didn't know anybody on the East Coast that could get you coke? If you don't know, I know people that I could get coke from on the East Coast, and I am not an underworld figure.
Well, and also, how does this get him killed instead of him killing somebody?
Yeah.
If this guy took 30 grand of his money, oh, now he's going to go to Hollis, Queens and finish his ass off? The fuck?
It's Christmas time in Hollis, Queens.
I mean, maybe that's how they do it in Hollis, Queens. It's not how they would do it in Bay Ridge, I'm pretty sure.
I cannot imagine that that's how they do it anywhere. And so, yeah, I mean, this, I understand that you have to present a couple of theories to sort of fill out your hour, but this,
not these.
I find, yeah, not these. Come up with some better ones.
And they don't spend nearly enough time, in my opinion, talking about the fact that, I mean, it comes up a couple of times that people are like, the reason that the cops can't solve this case is because either people in the neighborhood saw things and are not talking, or people did agree to talk, like the woman at the desk at the studio who was an eyewitness, but they mm-hmm. wouldn't give her witness protection, so she refused to testify. Like, but I don't think they spend enough time on the idea that, even though it's brought up repeatedly, that, or the allegations that, which I think are grounded, honestly, that that law enforcement doesn't try that hard to solve murders of hip-hop stars or people in the hip-hop world.
Or people of color. Or yeah. really, like, or any case that seems difficult. I mean, and anybody yeah. who's on Next Door will see that allegation. You know, the cops don't care about this. The cops are just eating donuts. The cops are just doing that. So, I mean, I feel like, you know, if I were going to mine a vein and I wanted people on my side, I would spend a lot more time, you know, looking into or talking about why the cops aren't trying harder or something, as opposed to all this other stuff. But I don't know, maybe that's not as fun.
Well, and you do wonder, like, well, all right, I'll just play clip 9, because this guy's like, why is this case is not that hard?
I don't believe that it's that hard to really solve this case. You know, it is a number of really compelling elements, but, you know, these are elements that, you know, the police are responsible for.
We're in a commercial district. They got to be cameras all over Jamaica Avenue. You know, that's what they do. They when you, especially in a commercial area, 89th Avenue, Jamaica Avenue, the precinct is right here, the parking lot. You got Jamaica bus terminal. This was a bank robbery or something like that. They zero in on about a certain radius, and they zero in on license plates, and then that's how they able to pull up suspects. I've never heard of anyone looking into that. I've never heard of that.
I mean, you can bet that if some cop named Moynihan got shot, they'd have gotten the cameras. And I guess NYPD could argue, like, well, you know, the businesses, like, CCTV wasn't that common back then, like, but it was 2002. Like, after 9/11, there were cameras.
Well, and, you know, if we go to your Moynihan example, what would happen is that everybody would be shaking down every CI, every potential witness, everybody they knew, every dirtbag, excuse me, everybody that anybody had a little bit on, they would be talking to, and, you know, and everyone would be motivated, too. And I think it's possible, you know, it's just nobody's that motivated to solve, you know, the slaying of somebody that has... is not even that relevant now.
Yeah. And
with all respect to the person's family, of course, everyone's relevant. No one should be killed, but I'm just, you know, talking about it from,
I mean, I still find it pretty shocking that this is an opportunity for NYPD, even if it's not necessarily true or sincere to, you know, put like, cross this murder of a beloved local figure who used to be a BFD to like, you know, take it off the board. So, you know, like, I would say I don't understand why more effort wasn't put in, but I do understand why. I just don't, you know, it's wrong, and it was also a bad call. Like, was bad and also looked bad, so. Our last clip, it doesn't really have anything to do with anything. It does mention the suspect that, according to my not all that deep research, does seem to be the most likely culprit, or at least was probably present. The eyewitness I mentioned before, Lydia High, did say that she made eye contact with this guy. He may not have been the shooter. The ways that various talking head interviewees come up with to call this gentleman trifler who sucked at being a criminal is pretty amazing. Here's our last clip.
Randy just took another route and started revealing information in hopes that it could put some pressure possibly to apply to the police and eventually lead to an arrest. In 2007, he revealed what Lydia had told the cops the night of the murder.
Ronald Washington was a guy that she looked face to face in his eyes.
Right.
So that alone, to me, the cops should have reacted.
Tenard was the kind of person that always stayed in jail. I mean, his whole life.
Tenard wasn't known as a drug dealer. He's just known as a foul person that would fucking rob you or anybody else. Like, that's just how he was. That's how he was known.
David Seabrook, come sit next to me. Yes, once again, our favorite literal insider, David Seabrook. But I just love the locution. He was always staying in jail.
I like foul person. Like,
yeah, I mean, all the ways that stay could be used there. Just, it made me laugh.
Well, foul person to me sounded like, you know, the beginning of Extra Hot Great. Like, I could hear David C. Cole saying, and foul person, Eve Beatty, you know.
I'm going to fucking rob you.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. That would be my. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It was just a really flavorful way of putting things. And that's the thing about this show. Like, they get really good visuals. They have access to really impressive, like, they get good music rights. Okay, some of the background cues are a little melodramatic, but this is a well-made show that's good to look at, and in that behind the music way, it is like very sort of structurally predictable and like not soothing exactly, but it's just a good thing to like have on. But unfortunately, as a true crime product, there's definitely these places where you can tell that, like, nobody actually believes this theory, but they have to fill time. Or what's really going on is a little bit too sociologically dense, and they don't have enough time. Because this is a, like, you know, 55-minute, 57-minute look at a musician or a group and his, her, their demise, and there's steps that have to be taken, and they're not really gonna push those boundaries. And it's, I mean, it's kind of too bad, because I just kind of wish that this had been a behind the music about Run DMC.
Yeah, I think that there's a nice biography channel Run DMC thing somewhere that, you know, people unfamiliar with Run DMC, not that you are, but like the kids in the audience could watch and get, you know, sort of that part of it. Now, I do know that BET is looking to put, you know, to sort of double down a bit more on true crime. So I sort of have hopes that as they continue to sort of build out their stable of true crime offerings, that, you know, maybe some of the folks there will take a run at a story like this, because I feel like, given everything with it, this is something that I could see this being like a, you know, a 3-episode sort of limited show or something like that, where you dive a little bit deeper with some of this stuff.
Yeah. No, and I would absolutely watch that. And their original programming slate, even if it's not to do with true crime, the stuff that I've seen so far has been really good. So,
oh yeah,
I would actually prefer, I think. And you know what? While they're up, they can do the Meek Mill story.
Yeah.
Because again, like, Free Meek was very good, but maybe another pass at it. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Especially if he's in it, because he's awesome. Mm-hmm. Speaking of awesome, Eve, plug your shit, please.
Oh, well, you know, I would just like to encourage everybody again to subscribe to Best Evidence. I have so much fun writing it every day with you, Sarah. And, you know, it's great to have free subscribers. I hope that everybody who's listening is a free subscriber. But if we have paid subscribers for only $5 a month or $55 a year, that will enable us to create so much more original content like coverage of the Theranos trial.
That's true. And it makes a great gift.
It does make a great gift because a lot of you guys already subscribe and we are so appreciative. And every time we see that we get a paid subscription, we message each other on Slack and it's really exciting. And anyway, it's at bestevidence.fyi.
Yep. Just a reminder, 2,000 paid subscribers. We are covering the Theranos trial.
3, I already have 2 black turtlenecks. You guys, I'm ready.
It.
Yeah. Oh,
yes, we are.
Yep.
Eve, thank you again for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Alex Segura on Leah Carroll's Down City and the Yahweh Ben Yahweh case. Once again, that's a book, Leah Carroll's Down City. So if you want to read along and have thoughts as you're listening next week, take that out of the library now. After that, it's Will Leach on Mindhunter and The Informant and John Ramos on The Bridge and Tunnel Crowd and some con artists. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter, and at Eve's and My True Crime Review newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so that other listeners can find it. If you don't like the podcast, please keep that to yourself. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time. Folks, weird line readings like that is why you gotta listen all the way to the end, because over-caffeination might bring you a surprise.